this time on your weekly Constitutional, the constitutional implications of tariffs.
One of the big questions about the imposition of tariffs is who has the constitutional power to impose tariffs. And there it's clear that Congress has the power, but must delegate that power to carry out its power to the president. And the president has used that delegated power to impose coercive sanctions on China and on other countries in order to try to reduce the United States trade deficit in a way that doesn't seem to be working.
That was Joel Trachtman of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about Tariff Man.
Don't change that station. It's time for your weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Tariffs are very much in the news these days. The trade wars that our president has initiated with the European Union, with Canada, certainly with China, often involve raising tariffs. What exactly are these things? Where do they fit into the Constitution? And has our current president exceeded his constitutional powers?
I'm Joel Trachtman. I'm professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, which is a school of international relations at Tufts. I run the Masters in Law program, and I'm the author of The Tools of Argument, a book about legal argument.
That's very interesting. The Master of Law program for the uninitiated, what is that all about?
It's for students who want to learn more about international law, students who already have a law degree but want to specialize in international law in an interdisciplinary context, looking at the economics, politics, history, business aspects of international law.
Our subject today is something called tariffs, in which you are an expert. Could you tell us what a tariff is?
Sure. A tariff is a tax on imports as they come in. Mm-hmm. And it's formally paid. The person who gets the bill is the importer. But there's also a question who bears the economic cost of that tariff, whether it's the seller or the buyer.
So if I'm importing something to the United States, let's say I'm the ABC Imports Company based in New York City, and I want to buy some European beef or something of that sort and bring it in and then pass it along and somebody will sell it inside the United States, I'm actually the entity then that will pay this tax on the import, at least in the first instance. And then the question becomes, how ultimately and to what extent is that cost passed along to consumers or somebody else?
Exactly so. And ordinarily, the consumers and the seller share it to some extent based on market power, based on the structure of the market, the competition in the market. Where a country is very powerful in economic terms in a particular good, where it's got monopsony power, it could impose most of the costs on the seller, on the foreign exporter. But in this particular case of the current tariffs being imposed by the United States on China, economists who have looked at the facts have found that most of the costs are being borne by the United States purchasers, the consumers who purchase those goods or the companies that purchase those goods as intermediate products.
You've gone right to the heart of the issue, but before we get to the present day, there's a long history of tariffs that predates the existence of our federal union. In fact, the British Empire operated under something called the mercantilist system. And weren't there lots and lots of tariffs and import taxes back in the day?
Yes. And the idea of mercantilism was to maximize your gold. And the thought then was to have more exports and fewer imports. We now know that that is a defunct theory of economics. We now know that imports are good, and especially in modern production, where companies buy a lot of intermediate products. We have network production where companies buy a lot of components and then assemble them or use them in their manufacturing. putting tariffs on imports is dangerous for a country. And so that mercantilist perspective just has never been correct and is especially incorrect today.
Well, you can see the lure of it, though, can't you? I mean, if I'm exporting more than I'm importing, then that means that money, and specifically gold, as you say, is piling up in my vaults. And that makes me feel good and secure and powerful. And to some extent, that's true. I mean, if I've got a big vault full of gold, then if I need it, I've got money to spend. On the other hand, until such time as I actually do something with that gold, what I've got is a situation where I'm giving other countries more than they're giving me.
Precisely so.
Yeah, and if you take the money out of the equation, and after all, money is... there's nothing inherently valuable about money. It's a means of exchange. It's a way to keep track of things. Certainly a store of wealth. But if you take that out of the equation and you simply look at what's happening, is it really good to be sending more stuff to other people than they're sending to you? And so as you were heading toward, the modern view is that you really want more of a balance, don't you?
That's true. If people are sending us more stuff and not requiring us to pay for it, we're in a sense better off. We've got more stuff and they've got less stuff.
Okay. There's also the issue, though, of employment, because if they're sending us more stuff than we're sending them, then arguably that leads to less employment in our country. Isn't that true?
I think that is complicated. Mm-hmm. And both markets, both the exporting country market and the importing country market, will tend towards equilibrium. And so it's not necessarily so much a matter of employment, it may be a matter of wages, but there doesn't seem to be a very significant effect of trade deficits, certainly on employment or actually on wages. As a particular industry, maybe we can think about a worker in a particular industry, as that industry is subject to competition and loses in that competition, then that industry could decline and workers could lose their jobs or wages could be reduced. But the idea of trade is that we'll find other things that we're good at, and the principle of comparative advantage says that we'll find something to sell, and we're always better off buying the cheaper, better stuff that others offer when they do, and selling them our things that we can produce most efficiently in exchange for that. And that results in the greatest welfare and doesn't have an effect on employment.
The greatest welfare globally, at least, and also to some extent, as you were pointing out, even on a national level. So in other words, trade deficits don't matter.
Well, you know, it's true that they matter for macroeconomic purposes. It could affect the value of your currency, your interest rate. So trade deficits are important, but they're actually not affected by trade policy very much. And the cause of trade deficits are the differences between savings and investment in the particular country, in the United States, in our case. So when we have a difference between saving and investment, that's what causes our trade deficit. And if we've got a big trade deficit with, let's say, China, and we say we're not going to buy any more stuff from China, that will not reduce our global trade deficit, because our trade deficit is caused by something else. We'll buy more stuff from Vietnam or Mexico or Canada to replace that. So the idea that you can attack a particular country in connection with a bilateral trade deficit and reduce your overall trade deficit is fallacious.
That's very interesting. So it's fundamentally a question, in the United States at least, that we consume to a much greater extent than we save and invest. And as long as we do that, we're going to have a high demand for all goods, but including foreign goods, and that will tend to contribute to our buying more foreign stuff and increasing the trade deficit.
Yes.
I got that right? Okay, good.
Makes sense. I think so, yeah.
Okay. You used a word a few minutes ago that I know people are still scratching their heads over. Could you define what a monopsony is?
Oh, a monopsony is someone who has what we would otherwise call a monopoly as a buyer. So they have market strength over purchases. So if I'm the only buyer of your good in town, I can exert market power against you and cause you to reduce your price. And so what I was saying is that in very limited cases, a country has that kind of power. And when it imposes a tariff, it can cause foreigners to reduce their prices and absorb the cost of the tariff. So that's what we look for in trying to figure out, at least in theory and then in practice, to what extent a tariff is being borne by the importing country or the exporting country.
Very, very good explanation. I think people might have experienced this. If, for example, there really is only one large business in town that's buying a product, an agricultural company that is the primary or only buyer of corn in Iowa has a lot of power to set the price of corn. And so I think that's what you were talking about there. Again, I'd like to go back into history. Under the mercantile system that the British imposed upon their empire and other empires did as well, they imposed a lot of these import taxes, and that really had a profound effect on our history. I mean, many of our founders, at least a few of them, I think I'm thinking of John Hancock and his family especially, made a lot of money smuggling goods to get those goods around all of these tax collectors. And it created a whole sense of tax rebellion in the nation that I think to some extent exists even to this day. It also led to all sorts of problems with the Fourth Amendment because of those writs of assistance, which the British gave to their customs people. And they would just come in people's houses without any warrants and rifle through everything, looking essentially for contraband and other evidence of smuggling. And all of that was caused because of the significant costs that were being imposed on international trade.
Of course, in those days, there wasn't anything like our modern income tax. And so the tariff was a much more important means of funding government. Today, for developed countries like the United States, the tariff is not nearly as significant a source of government revenues. And that, you know, plays into one of the assertions that President Trump has made, that by imposing tariffs on China, we're really increasing our treasury. It's not really very significant in relation to what our government spends and what the tax revenues are.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and my guest this week is Joel P. Trachtman. He's a professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and he specializes in international trade and things like tariffs. So that's what we're talking about. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Our current president has called himself Tariff Man. That seems to suggest he has an awful lot of power to set tariffs, to raise them or lower them as he sees fit. Is this constitutional? Well, I'm talking to Joel P. Trachtman of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and we're just about to get to that part of our discussion. What's the constitutional basis? This is, after all, a show about the Constitution. Where does the Constitution say that we can levy tariffs, and who gets to do that?
Well, if you don't mind, let's go back to the Articles of Confederation.
Oh, I love going back to the Articles. Please.
I thought you might.
Okay.
So the Articles of Confederation did not give the federal government power over tariffs. In fact, they let each of the states control tariffs. And so the United States was not what we call a customs union. It didn't have a common external tariff. And indeed, it was possible for there to be tariffs between the states. So one of the motives for negotiating the Constitution in 1787 was to unify the United States from a tariff standpoint. And that was done through the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which gives the Congress the power, quote, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes.
Well, that's very interesting, because before this discussion we're having right now, I've long wondered whether Congress utilized that very specific power, or whether, since a tariff is, after all, a tax, it instead utilizes the taxing power. Is there ever a utilization of that power as well?
I don't have the answer to that question. What I can say is every statute that I've examined in connection with tariffs has referred to the Commerce Clause authority. And I think for these purposes, tariffs are not considered taxes, although they're substantively similar or identical to taxes.
Well, that's the answer I would have guessed if I'd thought about it, because that Commerce Clause is so very specific about regulating international trade. So that does make sense. And it's kind of interesting, whenever you write a federal statute, you're at least supposed to begin with something called a whereas clause that talks about the problem and then says, so therefore be it enacted by the House and the Senate combined in Congress, and then pursuant to this power. And so the one that they cite in all the statutes you've looked at has been the commerce power rather than the taxing power.
Yes.
Okay, very good. So it's Congress that has the power to impose these tariffs. How does it do that? Through statute?
Yes, it does it through statute. And by the way, the Commerce Clause, as you know, is the basis for most federal legislation today as well.
Right.
And it's an exclusive power vis-a-vis the states. So the states don't have the power to levy tariffs. And if they do other things that can interfere with interstate or international commerce, that can be blocked by what we call the Dormant Commerce Clause.
Joel, you are just giving me warm fuzzies here. It's so rare that I get a chance to talk on this show about the Dormant Commerce Clause. So could you describe that? What do you mean by Dormant Commerce Clause?
Well, it's not quite total exclusivity. It doesn't mean that the states can't legislate. So California can regulate products of various kinds. But where the federal government legislates, it preempts state regulation. And also where a state imposes some regulation that discriminates against either explicitly or implicitly interstate or foreign commerce, then the courts can apply that Dormant Commerce Clause to strike down the state regulation that interferes with commerce, that violates the Commerce Clause. So it's an exclusive grant in that sense vis-a-vis the states, and getting to, I think, what one of the things you want to discuss.
But also, let me interrupt you again, Joel. I'm sorry.
Sure, sure.
This is such an interesting thing. First of all, the commerce power is a huge power, and it affects all kinds of things, or Congress uses it to regulate all kinds of things that at first glance don't even look like commerce, including even civil rights, for example. And that's the debate we had over the Affordable Care Act and the individual mandate, was whether that went too far. And that was one of the very few limits that the court has ever put on the Commerce Clause itself when it's utilized specifically by Congress. But what's really fascinating here is that the commerce power is so big, it's so powerful, that even when Congress doesn't act, when it doesn't actually pass a statute pursuant to the Commerce Clause, in situations where a state simply does something that arguably interferes with this power of Congress to regulate interstate commerce, then it turns out that it's possible that that'll be struck down because of a power that Congress hasn't even utilized.
It is an interesting, as you're suggesting, I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're quite right. It's an interesting interpretation of a grant of legislative power.
Oh, yes, and it's not without controversy. I sometimes try to give my students a visual. I say, imagine the commerce power is this green glowing mass in the basement of the Capitol building, and this green glow casts itself all over the United States, even when Congress doesn't touch it. And it essentially creates, at least within the boundaries of the United States, a free trade zone. And so, as you say, anything that a state does, certainly that discriminates against interstate commerce, or that even impedes interstate commerce, can run afoul of this green glow, and kind of like kryptonite, it's going to stop the state from doing what it's trying to do.
Yes.
Okay, that's
yes.
Just cool. Okay, I'm not aware of any other part of the Constitution that works quite that way. So thank you for bringing it up so that we could talk a bit about it and probably confuse 10,000 people just now. Okay, so most of the time, Congress acts pursuant to statute. And who implements these tariff statutes that Congress passes? Or what's in these statutes typically?
So there are statutes that specifically set the tariffs of the United States, the tariffs that the United States applies to imports from all other countries. And then there are statutes that implement free trade agreements like the World Trade Organization agreement, like the North American Free Trade Agreement, or it's currently being debated replacement. Those statutes delegate power to the president to set tariffs in accordance with their mandate. And they will say you can set tariffs in accordance with this agreement. There are also other statutes that we can discuss that give the president specific conditional authority to modify those otherwise applicable tariffs.
So Congress draws up a statute. The president signs it, or it's passed over his veto. It goes into law, and part of that statute basically just kicks the bucket over to the White House and says, okay, Mr. President, within these parameters and for these purposes, you now have authority to get down and do the specific rates or to change the rates. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, and just a footnote to that statement, the president has no undelegated power over commerce. That Commerce Clause has also been read as an exclusive grant of power to the Congress vis-a-vis the president. That's the Barclays Bank case in 1994. And so the president doesn't have power unless he gets that statutory delegation from Congress.
That's an important point, because sometimes the president will have independent Article II powers to do a thing, but then Congress will also have something to say about it. This is particularly true in national security matters. And so sometimes you've got competing branches of government citing competing clauses in the Constitution, and the courts essentially have to do some sort of balancing act between these constitutional powers. But you're saying in this case of commerce, it's all about Congress, at least in the first instance, and the president only has power that he gets delegated through statutes.
That's well said. The president, as you say, has his own set of powers. This comes up, the problem you've described comes up in the area of termination of trade treaties, where the president is the unique voice of the United States, and as a matter of some level of constitutional practice, it seems that the president has the power, perhaps, to terminate all treaties. But when the president terminates trade treaties, he's in effect regulating commerce. And so it comes up as a conflict with this exclusive grant of authority to the Congress. So that's another very difficult issue where the framers didn't specify every allocation of authority and what to do when these kinds of conflicts come up, and it will be up to this constitutional gloss or up to the Supreme Court to determine how this type of power is allocated. But in the area of setting tariffs, it's clear that the president has no undelegated authority to set tariffs.
Let's talk about that a little bit more, because you're so right. Generally speaking, when it comes to foreign affairs, the president's pretty close to being a king. I mean, he pretty much gets to do what he wants to do. He can even bypass the entire treaty requirement by going into executive agreements with other nations, and the Supreme Court will treat it just like a treaty. And that includes terminating treaties as well. But in the area of trade, Congress's power over international trade is so powerful and so total that there's an issue. Does the president have the power to terminate those kinds of treaties, trade treaties? Has the court ruled on that up to this point?
No, it hasn't. In Goldwater versus Carter, the court found it to be a political question, but I think recent jurisprudence, the first Zivotofsky case, suggests that that idea is no longer correct, and I don't think it ever was. This is not a political question, because it's a judicially determinable question of what does the Constitution say about the allocation of power between the president and the Congress.
The political question doctrine is a doctrine whereby the court, the Supreme Court or another federal court, will simply refuse to hear a case, not because it's politically charged, and that's why I submit it's probably a very poorly named doctrine because it's confusing. We know that the courts do politically charged cases all the time, but rather because the courts consider themselves to be non-political, but the other two branches of the national government, the Congress and the President, are political. And so what the court will periodically say is, this is a dispute between two branches of government. This is something that for the political branches, the Congress and the President, to work out on their own. It's kind of like parents upstairs in the living room saying, you kids settle this yourself. And that is what they have done, at least in a case involving termination. I think that was the Taiwan Treaty, wasn't it?
Correct.
Recognition of Taiwan, done in the wake of recognizing mainland China. And the court stepped back from that. And
so, That's right.
And effectively, that meant the president won.
Yes.
But you think that that was always a questionable doctrine, and a subsequent case, which case was that, has kind of put that into question?
It's the Zivotofsky case, which was a case about presidential versus congressional authority over passports and recognition. And there, the Supreme Court really reversed that type of holding in the Goldwater versus Carter case, and said we can answer this type of question. It's not a political question. It's a question about what the Constitution says. That's what we do, and what statutes say.
So you think then that the Supreme Court is primed to hear such a case? It will not dismiss it simply as a political question. And is that sort of thing on the horizon these days? Let's bring it up to the present day and everything that's going on.
Well, President Trump has threatened to withdraw the United States from the North American Free Trade Agreement. We now have a negotiated replacement that Congress is considering, and it may not be able to pass. And President Trump might purport to withdraw the United States from the North American Free Trade Agreement as a way of compelling Congress to act favorably on the replacement agreement. So that would be one way it could come up, and a company that was harmed by the tariffs that would be imposed if NAFTA were terminated might bring that case. And similarly, you know, the president has threatened to withdraw the United States from the World Trade Organization. And if that were to come up, it might be that you would see litigation about that, and it could get to the Supreme Court and be decided. So it's a live issue, and I know that there are people in Congress who are very interested in this issue. And those who are more in favor of free trade, which is actually most of the Congress, are concerned about losing these agreements. So they've been asserting that perhaps the president doesn't have this authority. And I think there are reasonable arguments that the president doesn't have independent authority in this area.
Very, very interesting. More broadly, I mean, you're an expert not just on law, but as your title says, international law, and you're at a place, the School of Law and Diplomacy. Going beyond the constitutional issues, you mentioned that most of Congress still favors free trade, but we now seem to be in an era where the president himself and many of his supporters do not. Could you comment on the present environment and what you think, what sort of effects you think it's having on the economy of the world, and indeed even the international order that's been around since the end of World War II?
Well, those are good questions. I think that there's no doubt that the president's actions in imposing large tariffs on Chinese goods, including mostly so far intermediate products, which are used by United States manufacturers to manufacture here, and steel and aluminum for countries all around the world, which are also used by manufacturers. Those tariffs have hurt the United States by making the United States a more expensive place to produce goods. And so when we put that tax, which is substantively, as we said, what it is, on imports, we're taxing our own production for domestic consumption or for export. We're making our exports more expensive, less competitive. And so the United States economy is suffering. And, you know, the United States economy is still doing well, but it would be doing better. And a lot of this will have effect in the future if these tariffs were not in place. And I just saw that the investment banking firm Morgan Stanley said that if the tariffs are raised, we would definitely see a recession within 9 months. So, you know, that's out of my league in terms of knowledge and prediction. But I think there are significant risks. And we've seen a reduction in the growth of exports, a reduction in the growth of investment in the United States. And part of the reason is that it becomes less attractive to invest in the United States if these intermediate goods and raw materials that you would otherwise import become more expensive. So that's the United States. For the world, you know, tariffs, it's just kind of Econ 101 that the more tariffs there are, the more everyone is made worse off. You're driving wedges of inefficiency between buyers and sellers, skewing decisions, giving the business to less efficient producers, making all sorts of production more costly and making our consumption more costly.
Yes, indeed. And I guess it just depends on one's perspective. Going back all the way to the mercantile era,
right?
People defined their self-interest very narrowly. You know, I am Great Britain and I only care about my people working and piling up gold in my vaults. And I want to control trade for that purpose. I'm going to go out and conquer colonies for that purpose, to give me raw materials and to provide me somebody to buy my finished manufactured goods. And I'm going to prevent people from the next empire down the road from doing that. And as you say, that even extended to individual states after we declared independence, who would do exactly the same thing. But what might be good in the short term for the Commonwealth of Virginia or for the United States as a whole is going to make trade by and large more expensive. And the other side's probably going to retaliate. So each of you starts constructing these walls, these barriers to trade, and everybody's expenses goes up and everybody's consumption goes down. I seem to recall something from high school about a particular tariff called the Smoot-Hawley tariff in the 1930s. Is there any comparison between that and what we're experiencing today?
You know, that was bigger than what we're experiencing today, but we're starting to see some escalation. You know, on August 1st, President Trump said he will put another tranche of tariffs on, and as these things go up, and as you say, as there is retaliation, then it has a certain life of its own. One of the things that China has put on the table, I guess, yesterday or maybe it was this morning, is currency manipulation. China has been accused of currency manipulation. It probably has done far less of that than it's been accused of, at least in recent years. But it's now reduced the value of the Chinese currency, the renminbi. And that reduction in value makes Chinese exports cheaper. It may countervail to some extent these tariffs that the president is threatening. And it's a way that China can respond to the U.S. action. So as you recall, you know, putting it in our discussion, Smoot-Hawley, you'll also recall that there was competitive devaluation in the run-up to the Great Depression. So we're starting to see some of the things, you know, what do they say? History doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
It rhymes,
we're starting
yeah.
to see some replication of some of the conditions that had some causal role in the Great Depression.
Well, that's kind of scary. Are we receiving some echoes of the Great Depression, the lead up to it? My guest is Joel P. Trachtman. And if you want to hear the end of the story, you'll have to stick around. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. Now it's time to finish our discussion with Joel P. Trachtman, a professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy of Tufts University. And we're talking about tariffs, and we're talking about not just the constitutional aspects of them, but other implications as well. It's as if you have your antenna out right now and you're receiving signals. I just pulled up CNN as you were talking, And the headline is that the Dow plunges 800 points, and I'm reading this on August the 5th, 2019, Dow plunges 800 points after China devalues its currency.
Right.
So we're seeing exactly the same sorts of things happening, as you say, not identical, but they rhyme, with trade barriers being erected, with tariffs being imposed, with people devaluating their currencies. Explain again, why would China do that? What advantage would China hope to gain by devaluing its currency in the current trade war?
I think they want to demonstrate to President Trump that they can impose pain on him. You know, this August 1st announcement of the next round of tariffs was an escalation by President Trump. And I think they're trying to say we can do things also. And they also decided at the same time to cut grain imports from the United States. So so they're saying, you know, this can harm both of us, because President Trump seems to be acting as though, or speaking as though, that we can harm China without China responding effectively and harming us. And I think Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, wanted to show that they can do the opposite. Now, it's important to say that this particular devaluation of the renminbi is small and won't have significant effects, but I think the stock market response is probably partly an anticipation of greater instability in the future.
Okay, Joel, now if you could explain to me, please, a little bit more in detail about what devaluing its own currency, how that's going to hurt the U.S., because to the casual person, you know, devaluing a country's own currency sounds like it's bad for that country. I mean, wouldn't we all like to have a dollar that's more valuable? But it does have a positive effect on, potentially, on other people's willingness to buy your products, because now with a devalued currency, they're cheaper. So by devaluing its currency, China makes its products more attractive to foreign buyers. Is that correct?
That's correct. China makes its products more attractive to foreign buyers. By the way, China is also hurting its own production because it makes it more expensive for China to import intermediate products and raw materials, including things like oil and steel. So it's not good for China to do this, but I think it's a demonstration, and it's also designed to, in part, counteract the United States tariffs.
Yeah, there are winners and losers every time a country takes or intervenes anyway in trade. And I was thinking on a much more personal level that it would be perhaps better for the United States to allow its own currency to become less valuable on the international market in order to increase our exports. But that runs directly counter to how I would feel as an American tourist over in Europe right now. If I'm the tourist, I want that dollar to be as valuable as possible because I'm over there spending it in foreign countries.
Right. And so, it allows us to buy imported goods more inexpensively.
Exactly. So for American consumers, at least in the short run, a strong dollar is a great thing. But maybe it's not if you're worried about how much you're exporting and you're worried about jobs at home. So none of these decisions, none of these action has clear-cut advantages or disadvantages across the board. Okay, so once again, you're scaring me, or maybe I'm scaring myself here with all this talk about 1930s economic policies. We all saw where that went, leading, of course, to the Great Depression and World War II and all that nasty stuff. After World War II, there was a sense of never again, and Britain and the United States really constructed a whole new international economic order, didn't they?
That's right. The United States Secretary of State at that time, Cordell Hull, thought that one of the causes of the Second World War was trade tensions between the United States and Japan. And he wanted very much to multilateralize, to organize trade so that we wouldn't have these kinds of trade tensions and these causes, as you suggested, of the Great Depression again. And so that resulted in the Bretton Woods Conference, not too far from me in New Hampshire, where the United States, the United Kingdom, a number of other countries came together and formed the IMF and the World Bank, and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade came out of those negotiations as well. And that General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade was the predecessor of the World Trade Organization that exists today. And so it was a way of avoiding competitive devaluations. It was a way of avoiding trade wars. And it seems to have worked reasonably well and has protected the world from these kinds of problems up until today. In fact, many were worried in the 2008 financial crisis that people would start violating those rules and that we would have the kind of unilateral action that could cause serious problems with those retaliations and competitive devaluations. But the system seemed to have held. And the question is that you're quite rightly raising now is, will the system hold today? And we'll have to see about competitive devaluations. But what I would say is that the international legal trade system, the World Trade Organization, which has been expanded and strengthened significantly since 1947 when it was first formed, is under grave threat. And both the United States and China are flagrantly violating those rules in their trade war.
We set up a whole system, an international system, because we thought we'd learned our lessons from the 1930s. And so we, as you say, constructed a system that worked reasonably well. You mentioned the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, now the World Trade Organization. That basically prohibited these practices, these competitive devaluings of currency, raising tariffs unilaterally. The International Monetary Fund, or the IMF, has a complementary function. Could you describe that a little bit, please?
Well, its function is to regulate the way that countries use monetary policy, use devaluation of their currencies, and to prevent the kind of competitive devaluation, the kinds of restrictions on exchange control on exchange that led to the Great Depression. So that's worked reasonably well over the years to provide order in the international monetary system.
And monetary policy, of course, has to do with regulating the size of the money supply and interest rates, right? That's monetary policy is what we're talking about.
Yes, and those things have an effect on exchange rates.
Exactly. So it's all interconnected here. Now, the problem with any international agreement is that there is no coercive power at the top of the heap. Unlike any individual country, with its highest court in the land, with its enforcement mechanisms, if a country decides that it's not going to enter into one of these agreements, or alternately, that it's going to violate one of these agreements, it's problematic as to what sort of sanction it may face. And what it boils down to is that the other members of the organization may decide or may not decide to punish the offending party. And so there is a lot more flexibility in terms of how an individual country acts in the international sphere than typically exists within a given country. And that can create all sorts of problems, as we're seeing right now, as we saw back in 2008. I mean, what can we do about China devaluing its currency other than retaliate in kind or in some other fashion? And then you're back to the Wild West. Then the whole system starts to unravel.
Yes. In the international legal context, you know, there's no monopoly on the use of force. There's no sheriff who can come in and force folks to comply with their obligations. So we rely on a kind of, as you say, decentralized system, a system where, in a sense, the system itself is valuable and is held hostage to compliance. So if you start failing to comply and destroy the system, you lose yourself the overall value of the system. So it's kind of broad reciprocity that seems to work. And in the World Trade Organization in 1994, we moved to mandatory dispute settlement where we can have binding interpretation of the treaty. And as you can imagine, that reduces the scope for flexibility for saying, no, I'm in compliance or you're in violation. Now we have a system for conclusively determining that. The United States has been undermining that system, and that system will cease to operate in December because of United States' refusal to appoint new judges to that system.
And what's the name of that system?
It's the WTO appellate body.
So again, we encounter an issue that we've discussed many times here. Courts by themselves have no ability to enforce their own opinions. I mean, if a court issues a ruling and the parties ignore that ruling, what can the court do? I mean, they're a bunch of old gray-headed men, typically. They don't have weapons. They don't have armies. They can't force people to do what they've ordered them to do. Courts rely upon governments, and specifically the executives of governments, to enforce their rulings. And more broadly, they rely upon the acceptance of society of the legitimacy of those rulings, which is why it's such a concern whenever people start to question the legitimacy of the court, and especially our Supreme Court, because that undermines the ultimate authority of that court. But in an international context, there, again, is no coercive power. You've got a definitive resolution on paper of who violated the WTO or the IMF or whatever, but you still have no enforcement mechanism.
Yes. That system, however, has worked remarkably well even before the WTO came into existence in 1994. It's worked remarkably well, I think, because of a sense among countries that it benefited all of the member states. The United States was an important supporter with all of the economic power that the United States brings to the table. And, you know, reasonable heads of government found ways to move to compliance with those rules because they saw that the long-term compliance was in their national self-interest.
So again, it was voluntary and to some extent peer pressure and potentially the threat of other member nations retaliating in some concerted fashion if there's a bad actor. It sounds as if the United States may be a bad actor in terms of at least its support for the appellate body of the WTO. When did we start undermining that institution?
That's a good question. We actually started undermining it under the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. But it's probably true that under a Hillary Clinton administration, there would have been a willingness to compromise, to reach some agreement about going forward. The United States has some concerns about the way the appellate body has operated. Those concerns are based on very, very technical modifications that the appellate body has made in its own practice that are not of great substantive importance. But the United States, especially the United States trade representative, Robert Lighthizer, have been unhappy with some of the rulings. By the way, the United States wins as many cases as other states win, loses as many cases as other states lose. The United States has a perfectly good record of winning and losing at the WTO. But there are certain specific areas of protectionism in international trade in which the United States has been disappointed. And so under the Obama administration, there was the beginning of this application of pressure, and that's been continued in a way that we might have expected not to be continued under the Trump administration, to the point where, as I say, that system of binding dispute settlement will end in December if something isn't done about it.
Lots of people accuse China of taking advantage of this World Trade Organization and cheating a lot. Is that a primary cause, perhaps, of people becoming disillusioned with this international system is because we've let such a big economy come in and do things that undermine the system?
I think that we can't underestimate the eccentricity of President Trump in his perceptions of these things. But it's also true that China has been a problem. And China negotiated its joining of the WTO, which happened in 2001. And at that time, as you say, the United States and the rest of the world anticipated greater liberalization of the Chinese economy for autonomous reasons, but also because of the treaty. Xi Jinping, the current leader of China, has turned away from liberalization. And so China has not liberalized so much. And the WTO treaty is really written for countries that are not controlled economies the way China is. the protocol of China's accession, which is itself a component of the treaty, is very specific and tries to address a number of the differences of China, but it's still true that it doesn't address all of the concerns about a state-controlled economy, because the state can make purchase and sale decisions, subsidization decisions that are not well addressed by WTO law. And so the WTO treaty needed to be renegotiated. And the United States, if it had a different mindset, might have worked with other countries, with Europe and Japan and some of its other allies, to confront China and work on those issues. It may or may not have been successful. And one thing we can say is that President Trump, through these through this tariff war, has gotten China's attention. But the problem now is requesting the correct things of China. It's not correct to request China simply to buy more stuff, or even simply to respect United States intellectual property. We need more fundamental concessions by China, and they need to be negotiated very carefully, and they'll probably take a long time to work through.
Wasn't that what the Trans-Pacific Partnership was supposedly all about, bringing together a lot of allies, like-minded nations, to essentially pressure China into making these reforms?
Yes, it was. And so it's the idea, in part, behind the Trans-Pacific Partnership was to come up with an agreement that contained provisions that would address some of these concerns, not all of them. But some of these concerns, and then pressure China by entering into this agreement, impose pressure on China to join the agreement so that it would have the market access benefits provided by that agreement, and thereby require China, as you say, to make some of these changes in order to comply with that agreement.
All right. So this is all starting to look like part of a much bigger picture that we're seeing all around the world, from the Trump White House, to Brexit, to Japan and South Korea now, whereas we seem to be moving away from international cooperation and more towards unilateral national action. And I guess we're all just going to have to wait and see whether that works or not.
I suppose that's so. It's also possible that the United States turns around and begins to cooperate more. I think that on this trade war front, the strategy does not seem to be working, and it may be that President Trump at some point turns around, finds a way to make trade peace, and then you might see a rehabilitation of some of these multilateral institutions.
Yes, and I guess rainbows and unicorns might also exist. Thanks very much, Joel. We appreciate your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Stuart.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to my guest, Joel Trachtman of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. What an enlightening conversation, and kind of a scary one, too. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on Spotify. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.